Hello and welcome to Databook. I am Jack Murtha.
And I am Tom Castles. Thanks for joining us on this episode. If you like Databook, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review.
And remember, this is an Inside Digital Health podcast. You can find us online at idigitalhealth.com. And of course, we are on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. You know where to find us.
So please do that. Now let's dive right into today's episode. We continue today with the peer exchange discussion that we started 2 weeks ago on physician burnout.
Now, if you recall, this features health IT leaders such as Gita Nair, Rasu Shrestha, Janae Sharp, and Heather Lavoy.
But before we get into all that, we're going to go back in time yet again, as we are so wont to do. Our destination this time, the beginning of burnout.
Now, let's stop right there. We are not telling the story of the first person to get burnt out, because obviously that's an impossible task.
Instead, we're talking about the first person who shined a light on this phenomenon, the first person to even call it burnout.
Interestingly enough, this visionary was a clinician, but not a primary care doc or a nurse or a specialist.
It might be totally obvious, but the guy who jolted occupational burnout into the public consciousness was a clinical psychologist. His name was Herbert Freudenberger.
Who else would it be?
But he didn't just observe and analyze burnout. He didn't simply say, you know, this exists, it's a problem, and here are some things we can do to stop it.
Here's the thing. Herb Freudenberger suffered from burnout himself.
So our first stop in the life of Freudenberger brings us to 1930s Germany. It's a dangerous time for Herb and his family because, well, Herb and his family are Jewish.
Hitler and the Nazis are in power, and they're starting to exercise this power in some very violent, despicable ways.
So Herb's just 12 years old when he sees the Nazis burn down his synagogue. And not long after that, he leaves the country on his own and ends up in New York City.
Things are tough. Herb lives with his aunt, but she wants money that he and his family just don't have. It gets bad, and he ends up actually living on the streets for a little bit.
And then Herb meets up with a cousin whose family takes him in. Before you know it, he's working at some industrial plant. He's got no high school degree, just kind of scraping by.
But his new family doctor gets a load of this kid and says, wow, there's something here. And he pushes Herb to go to college. And eventually, Herb does just that.
He enrolls in Brooklyn College, and soon enough, he meets a psychologist named Abraham Maslow.
You know, the guy behind Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that Maslow.
Exactly. Now, Maslow is a big deal, and he sees something in Herb. So much so that Maslow takes him under his wing and becomes his mentor.
And with that, this kid who survived the Holocaust and the rough, uncertain streets of New York City sets down the path to becoming a psychologist.
Now, why are we digging this deep into Freudenberger's past? What does it matter in a conversation about burnout?
Well, outside of the fact that it's incredible.
Yeah, completely. A 12-year-old boy escaping Nazi Germany and becoming a legendary psychologist is truly an amazing story, but I think you know what I mean.
Okay, all right. Look, the thing about Herb Freudenberger's past is that it highlights a couple of sides to him that not everyone has. You know, it might have made him special. I'm talking about his dedication and his passion, his commitment to a cause, and his desire to put in the work needed to support that cause.
Those are two traits that, according to Herb, can be staunch allies or unforgiving enemies.
Let's fast forward a few years. By 1971, Freudenberger is a well-established psychologist. His practice in Manhattan is booming. He's teaching the bright young minds of tomorrow. He's got respect.
And he deserves it, but he's not stopping there. You see, Herb's really into the idea of free clinics. These are places where physicians can treat and counsel the marginalized and the poor at no cost.
So, in a paper titled The Free Clinic Concept, he recalls this 1967 conference in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, you know, where the hippies really came to be. So, mental health professionals, hippies, community leaders, the poor, the marginalized, they all showed up and they talked about how this crazy idea, this free clinic, just might work.
Herb loves the discussion, which apparently goes on into the wee hours of the morning. It clearly sticks with him because he ends up volunteering his own time in these free clinics.
And by 1971, when this paper that he publishes comes out, he is actually the director of psychological services at St. Mark's Free Clinic in the shady Bowery.
So it's some noble work that he's doing, the kind that feeds a person's soul, but probably not their bellies.
So Herb spends his days making money at his practice and his nights at the free clinic. It's not easy, and the days easily hit 14, 15 plus hours.
If his research and writing are any indication, he really finds this work fascinating.
Yeah, so in 1973, he publishes another paper, and this one's about psychologists in the free clinic. He really digs into this alternative model, offering up best practices, suggestions, and frameworks.
And he sees it as a conductor of social change. This is a place where everyday clinicians can fight the drug problem and even get involved in politics.
But Freudenberger also writes about role confusion and the work that volunteers have to take on. The free clinic, he says, requires a dramatic shift in the time that they can give to patients.
So in November of 1974, he publishes his next paper in the Journal of Social Issues. It's sort of the evolution, you know, the next natural step of his work over the past few years.
But this time, instead of focusing on treating the free clinic's patients, Herbert Freudenberger zeroes in on a major health problem facing its staff members.
This paper is called Staff Burnout, with a hyphen between burn and out. It's a landmark moment for psychology. The first professional observation and analysis of this thing that seems like chronic fatigue, maybe depression.
Freudenberger starts the 7-page paper by letting us in on a little inside baseball term among free clinic workers, burnout. It's like the cigarette of an addict. It just keeps going until it burns out.
He describes a condition in which leaders lose their charisma and ability to get the job done. Even their physical health is impacted.
Their colleagues at the free clinic begin talking crap behind the person's back, and they end up ultimately turning their backs on their friends.
The victim becomes emotional, suspicious, maybe a little overconfident, cynical, may even start using drugs.
This person just seems depressed. No one knows what's going on or what to do, but they know that something is definitely going down. And honestly, at this time, you know, it sounds a lot like Herb. He's yelling a little bit, his drive and his eventual inability to get out of bed. I mean, everything is there that's saying, hey, this is Herb.
So in the paper, he dishes out some tips for dealing with and preventing burnout. It's all directed towards the clinic, how the institution can care for its people.
But he also spends 4 paragraphs examining who exactly is prone to burnout. And the answer?
People who are dedicated. The folks who want to give and who work long, difficult hours to satisfy external and internal demands. Professionals who at some point find that their job is now a routine. It's become boring.
So, in other words, yet again, Herb.
That's right. So Herb and his colleagues have been struggling with burnout for some time now, and the world knows it now because of this paper. And you know what? Other people, they can really relate.
So this issue gains momentum. Herb releases a book that makes the burnout issue just explode into the mainstream. It becomes something that we as a society can no longer ignore, and other researchers begin digging deeper into this really big problem.
Over time, our understanding of burnout begins to evolve, and so does how we try to prevent or cure it.
But Herb's rudimentary look at burnout still resonates today. Many of his observations pop up in our talks about physician burnout, you name it.
And just like in the 1970s, we're still searching for a way to fight this scourge.
So now we're going to resume our discussion on physician burnout, because we recognize that we don't have steadfast solutions to this problem. And the only way to get to some is to keep the conversation going, not just about the problem, but about the future, a better future.
Right, and that's why we brought on 4 of the leading minds to figure this thing out. This conversation features Rasu Shrestha, Janae Sharp, Heather Lavoie,
and our host, Gita Nair, who starts us off.
really clear that technology is one aspect of this, right? But the harder part is the cultural component, mm-hmm. right? And we heard a little bit about the culture of Mayo Clinic and Atrium Health. How does you know, can and how could technology play a role in helping to shift the culture? Because that's really the hardest part. We have the technology, we have all kinds of stuff that can help our docs get more control, but really it's the cultural shift that yeah. needs the work.
So it's really interesting, and I think it's important for us to take a step back and look at some of the big themes, the dynamics that affect and influence how we use technology to influence what it is that we're doing in terms of providing care. For the longest time, as we've been rolling out EMRs in the instantiations that we have today, you know, we've been designing those solutions for regulation. And regulation inherently is not bad. It's there to protect us. It's there to protect the patient, like HIPAA and ICD-9 and 10 codes and all of that. But when do we start designing for empowerment? Right? Empowerment of the clinicians and of the patients and all of that. So I think designing for empowerment versus regulation is important. Designing for regulations has caused burnout. I think designing for empowerment will cause joy, which was a point that you made earlier. And I think the other thing we need to look at thematically and from a culture perspective too is today we're inundated with bureaucracy in healthcare. And I think what's really happening as we shift not just the conversations, but even the way that we're measuring outcomes, measuring satisfaction, and we shift from volume-based healthcare to value-based healthcare, we're quickly moving from bureaucracy to meritocracy. So rewarding merit, I think, is going to be really critical. And all of these instantiations of how culture is shifting will then suddenly influence the direction of how we then embrace technology in the design or the redesign of the solutions that we're using every day.
Those are some excellent points. You know, and so much in the health tech industry, we talk about patient engagement, right? We talk about all kinds of ways and technologies to engage the patients. But ultimately, if we think about technologies that can do physician engagement, the patient engagement aspect is going to follow, right? So any thoughts on technological innovations around physician engagement that can help shift the culture?
You know, I think it varies, you know, and you actually see a bit of a bifurcation for sort of newly graduated medical students as compared to people that are further along in their career and the methods by which you engage them and sort of their inclination to use technology first versus technology as a burden, so the expectations and certainly...
Well, it's intuitive for some and not as intuitive for others.
So the digital natives, as they graduate from med school, what's that going to look like?
Right. Right? Exactly. I mean, their expectations around using fax machines.
With Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. Someone asked me to send them a fax the other day, and I was like, are you kidding?
That's right.
And for much of the country, that's exactly the way physician practices still communicate.
But I wonder about that, because everyone's like, the fax is awful. I'm like, but really, it's an e-fax, and I can take a picture on my phone, sign it on my phone, and send a fax on my phone and get it uploaded into the exact file that I want it at.
So why can't you consent?
Yeah.
So what's wrong
with...
And what's worst is that then there are companies who come to you and say, but we've got a perfect solution. We can actually PDF the whole thing and put it in our EMRs. Oh, my goodness.
And you know who paid
them? When will we realize that PDF is not a digital format? I mean, my goodness, we cannot mine for the data sufficiently
in really,
PDFs.
If it can translate to Word, why can't we mine PDFs?
Oh, it's a struggle. It really is. I mean, discrete and data elements with the technologies that we have at hand, and we're still struggling with fax machines, and then the PDF is a slightly better solution. We can do better.
Engagement is so individualized. It really is based on, you know, what are people's values, what's important to them, and that's why it is so, it's not just different generationally, but it's really different from person to person. It's why it has to come from the top of an organization, because it's going to take a lot of work. It's a lot of emphasis. There's a great reward associated with it. If you actually invest the time and energy, you will have happy physicians. You will have better health outcomes. You will have happier patients. But understanding what's meaningful to each physician in order to engage them, that's a necessary component. And so it's not just a technology solution. I think technology can be an enablement platform, you know, a method, but really it's actually getting to understand, you know, what ticks for each individual physician? What are they looking for, and what's meaningful to them?
Can I say something else?
No, you can't.
I know. Well, I'm gonna. A lot of times we talk about how it has to come from the top, and I know in my experience, I wasn't at the top, and I decided I didn't care. So I don't think it does have to come from the top. I think physicians can say, look, this sucks, and they can find ways to make their voice heard. Like whether that's partnering, one of the greatest technology tools we have is something like media, something like online social media, where you can say, this isn't okay, and they can't stop looking at you because it's out there.
Sure. Like that's a fantastic point. I think it goes to culture, because to your point, whether it comes from the top or the bottom, it's about having a culture of being receptive, right?
Are you saying I was from the bottom? Because like maybe. Maybe it meant, I'd like to say I was in a different place.
I think generally we're in vehement agreement, I would think, that what we need to do is to speak up. Yeah. Right? So whether it's at the top or the bottom, we can't shove this under the carpets anymore. We have to speak up. We have to call it out. We have to then understand the specifics of what it is that we can do together, collectively, to actually address physician burnout.
I think those are all amazing points, guys. I guess there's one more closing thing I want to ask all of you. This is ultimately about resources, right? We talked about spending money on PDFs. We talked about spending money on some fax machines. And physicians are burnt out, right? And Janae, actually, rightfully so, whether you're in the middle, the bottom, the top, it shouldn't matter. You know, just quick thoughts on resource allocation and where that fits in here. Because we have the data. We know when we have a shortage of nurses, we have a shortage of docs on a certain floor. So, you know, how does resource allocation fit into this?
So it's interesting when you look at hospital operations and the specifics of what you measure around the widgets that go around and you know, heads in beds, for example, has been a metric that we've used for a long time. And quickly, as we look at value-based care, that metric is changing. It's not about heads in beds anymore. It really is about how do we make sure that we're able to provide care and get those patients out of the hospital beds as quickly as possible, because that defines the new success. Now, you overlay that with physician burnout and the things that we're measuring around physicians, right? There's still measures in place. So as a radiologist, how we are measured today is number of studies dictated and report turnaround time. Pure volume-based metrics. And that is just absolutely wrong. I'm not saying that volume-based metrics are going away. What I'm saying is if we continue to incentivize physicians with those volume-based metrics, then we're going to get more of the same, and that's not good enough for us.
I agree. I mean, the reimbursement system has really dictated a lot of this. There's so many cases where a low acuity patient with high blood who might be on blood pressure medication but is well managed, they could be monitored by a nurse. They don't have to present for a visit all the time. But yet, because of either quality standards, because of reimbursement, we're dragging people into the office. It creates a greater burden on the physician. It could be managed better by someone else. But because there hasn't been reimbursement for some of those types of services in the past, and that's changing now, whether it's because of value-based contracts or because CMS is allowing for, you know, certain care coordination services or monitoring services now, I think there's an opportunity for that to change so that not everything has to be done by the physician. Other people can actually manage, monitor, and maybe even to a greater effect if you have social workers that are interacting with patients who may be at home and have transportation barriers, that actually might result in better outcomes and save the right patients to present to the physicians. But much of this has also, you know, it's followed regulation, but it's also followed reimbursement.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of Databook. We hope you like the show, and if you do, please rate, subscribe, review, tell a friend.
Yeah, and we encourage you to engage with us on this topic and any others that you may see fit. And also reach out to the panelists that were in this conversation, Rasu, Janae, Heather, and Gita. They're great people, and they'd love to hear from you about this topic.
So we are Inside Digital Health, iDigitalHealth.com. You can find us on social media. I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.
And this is Databook.